Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The 23rd Psalm, a Holocaust Memoir, by George Salton with Anna Salton Eisen. Foreword by Michael Barenbaum. Narrated by Stephen J. Cohen. A Psalm of David. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He maketh me lie down in green pastures. He leadeth me beside the still waters. He restoreth my soul. He leadeth me in the paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for thou art with me. Thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. Thou preparest a table for me in the presence of mine enemies. Thou anointed my head with oil. My cup runneth over. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I shall dwell in the house of the Lord forever. Psalm 23, Jewish Family Bible. Foreword. We must be grateful to George Lucius Salton for writing his Holocaust memoir, which reflects the observational powers and the unflinching honesty of a 14-year-old boy who would later become an engineer and an outspoken advocate for oppressed humanity. Like many memoirs, this one is divided into three parts: before, during, and after. Yet the bulk of Salton's work details his multi-layered and complex experiences during the Holocaust. His life before is a prelude, setting the scene. His life after is a coda. He could not leave the story unfinished, because every listener will be interested in what happened to Lutzek Salzman, George Lucius Salton's pre-Americanized name. However, this is a Holocaust memoir. The standard Holocaust narrative for Polish Jews is ghettoization, deportation, death camp. And for those who did not die, the near impossible struggle for survival. But Lutzek Salzman's experience was different. When his parents were deported to Belzec from the Rzeszów ghetto, 14-year-old Lutzek remained in the ghetto, then was sent from one labor camp to another, and at the end of the war, from one concentration camp to another, when these camps were overwhelmed and had ceased to function, making daily life even more difficult. Salton writes in intricate detail of each step on his journey, each assignment, each of the many moments of crisis, and of the men with whom he shared his struggle. He also depicts his perpetrators, often by name, and the industries that exploited his enslavement. Salton's memoir was difficult to write and also difficult to read, not because he is unclear, but because he describes so precisely the conditions he faced, the crises he encountered, the degradation he endured, and the misery he withstood, so that we too, his audience, must feel some of what he felt. To experience this memoir properly, we must avoid the psychological numbness that he must have experienced. We can't shut down, but must remain open to truly grasp the importance of his work. As I read Salton's memoir, I kept thinking of another scientist who was engulfed by the Holocaust, Primo Levi, who found himself deported to a concentration camp. He applied his talent for observation, much as Lutzek did. However, Lutzek, though mechanically gifted and scientifically inclined, was a child, while Levi was a trained chemist who could more easily move from the particular experience to the principle that it illustrated. Yet we must be grateful to have young Lutzek's detailed observations. Salton's memoir is honest. Painfully, brutally honest. The true mark of such honesty is his abandonment of narrative depicting his own heroism and strength, and his willingness to discuss experiences that make him and his listeners uncomfortable. We learn of desperation from Sultan's memoir. Toward the end of the work, he describes cannibalism. "Do you know what you're eating?" "Potatoes with meat," I said, hoping that he would go away. "No, not meat. Human flesh, cut from the dead. They are cannibals." I remember the first time I heard of such cannibalism. I conducted a long interview with a survivor, after which he asked that we turn off the camera and shut down the recording. In soft, hesitant tones, he whispered, "We were so hungry that we even ate the dead." Sultan does not spare himself, hoping his fellow Polish inmate who told him what he was eating would go away and keep his mouth shut. Lutsek wanted what one might call plausible deniability, not admitting to his own desperation, to how low he had sunk. Another instance of painful honesty is his depiction of friendship. But first, let me offer some context. Throughout Lutsek's multiple, seemingly unending ordeals, he is buoyed by friendship. First, there was the love that he experienced from his older brother, Manek, who had been admonished by his mother just before their final deportation to take care of Lutsek, which Manek did with admirable dedication and courage until the brothers were forcibly separated and Manek went off on his own. Later, Lutsek received support from friends, including young men from his hometown of Tytsin, or his ghetto of Rzeszów. One survivor I knew well, as a friend, Mike Jacobs, observed, "No one survived alone. Everyone needed someone to keep them from the abyss, to help them in an inevitable moment of weakness, to keep them from becoming a Muslim, one who had given in to despair, who had nothing left, a walking dead man." Yet, lest the listener feel sentimental about friendships forged under oppression, Sultan observes, "I had learned to always cling to friends I could trust and not to rely on strangers. I could count on Emil Ringel, and he could rely on me. In all except the most desperate circumstances, we would not steal each other's shoes." No romantic depiction here, but an honest understanding that in extreme moments, slave laborers will do anything, anything and everything, to survive. Sultan reminds me of what Elie Wiesel wrote in his novel Day. "Suffering brings out the lowest, the most cowardly in man. There is a phase of suffering you reach beyond which you become a brute. Beyond it, you sell your soul. And worse yet, the soul of your friends, for a piece of bread, for some warmth, for a moment of oblivion, of sleep. Saints are those who die before the end of the story." Sultan is less poetic, more personal, more engaged, and so much less abstract that you feel his anguish. You know he is telling the truth, the painful truth. There are important pieces of historical information in Sultan's recounting of Lutsek's experience. Lutsek was enslaved by German corporations, including the prestigious Mercedes-Benz. Historians recount that German corporations invested 700 million in 1942 Reichsmarks in the slave labor complex Auschwitz III, Buna Monowitz. Those decisions were made in corporate boardrooms far from Auschwitz, not necessarily by Nazis, but by prominent executives who ran great corporations before the war and often after it. They presumed that slavery would be an ongoing part of the German economy, not only in wartime, but for the indefinite future. They simply wanted to cash in, to earn more profits for themselves and for their companies. Salton recounts that the Mercedes employees who supervised his work were just as cruel, just as driven, just as anti-Semitic as those men who were chosen, trained, and indoctrinated for the SS. He was also enslaved by the Hermann Göring Werke, the German conglomerate that provided one-eighth of Germany's steel output during the war. It was created to provide a Nazi-controlled military-industrial complex for the regime that would be uncompromised by private interests. By the end of 1941, the Göring Werke was the largest company in Europe and probably in the whole world, with a capital of 2.4 billion in 1941 Reichsmarks and about 500,000 workers. Lutzek Salzmann was one of those workers. Joseph Borkin, who wrote an important study of slave labor, The Crime and Punishment of I.G. Farben, writes, "They oiled the machines, they did not feed the prisoners." He could have used Lutzek's experience and George Salton's memoir as his proof text. There was a sameness to the treatment of Lutzek's experience, virtually identical inhumane living conditions and virtually identical cruelties perpetrated by the slave masters of the different industries and corporations. Factory foremen don't ordinarily behave this way. The conditions alone did not cause such behavior. It was the ideology that supported treatment of these laborers, especially the Jews, as subhuman, surely deserving of their enslavement. In one camp, Lutzek was assigned to work on aircraft, which was essential to the war effort. His supervisors were Luftwaffe German Air Force officials. Though they did not go through SS training and indoctrination, they too were capable of great cruelty. Lutzek's experience with them refutes the all-too-comfortable position of those who want to differentiate honorable German soldiers from SS personnel, as Helmut Kohl and Ronald Reagan tried to do at Bitburg. Almost all survivors claim that they survived because of a four-letter word, luck, which implies that someone wiser, stronger, and more deserving was in the wrong place at the wrong time and did not make it. The prisoner was shot with great accuracy or beaten with extra intensity. A bomb was dropped, even an Allied bomb, in the wrong place, and the prisoner was murdered or killed, and the survivor was spared. There is no answer to why. We can barely count the number of times that Lutzek was on the verge of death, or the moments where he ran out of strength and was just not going to make it when a friend offered him solace, a small piece of bread, a place to lie down, a drink of water. Yet Lutzek did not survive merely by luck. Read this book and see the pattern that developed. Unable to go to school, he was trained as a locksmith's apprentice. His mechanical skills made him useful. His work was apparently good. Prisoners had two conflicting survival strategies, volunteer for nothing or volunteer for everything. Lutzek chose the latter. When a master asked for people with specific skills, Lutzek stepped forward whether he had those skills or not. He tried repeatedly to prove himself useful to his masters. In a rational world, if a slave is useful to his masters, he will not be killed. In the Nazi universe, usefulness did not necessarily assure survival, because the slave was not a capital investment, but a consumable raw material to be discarded in the process of manufacture. The product was all important, the workers dispensable, virtually interchangeable. Recall, they oiled the machines, they did not feed the workers. In the Nazi mindset, some slaves were considered life unworthy of living, or useless eaters, which is how the Nazis spoke of people whom we humanely describe as having special needs. The Jews were considered a cancer, whose elimination was essential to the well-being of German society. Volunteering and making himself useful was one way that Lützeck fought for survival. He demonstrated his skills, even though he was but a child. Lützeck could distinguish between those who were relentlessly cruel for sport or for the joy of punishing their prey, and those who had moments of compassion or at least moments when the zeal to punish or kill gave way to laziness or indifference. He had a knack for making friends who could help him, and whom, in turn, he could help. These friendships were not only essential to his continued existence, but they were indispensable to his survival as a person. They preserved his humanity, at least some of it. Knowing that his food was inadequate, and that he would always be hungry, Lützeck tried not to eat at once all the food he was given. He disciplined himself, often unsuccessfully, to preserve some for later. Jewish listeners will recall that in the very first moments of the Passover Seder, one breaks the middle matzah and hides the larger piece for later. This ritual is a reminder of slavery, for when food is scarce and inadequate, one sets aside some food for another occasion when one is even more hungry. Lützeck described another survival strategy. Some French prisoners would cut their bread unevenly, giving one person almost a third of a loaf and others even smaller portions of bread, day by day, for 10 days. But on the 10th day, the rotating prisoner would have a feast, a third of a loaf of bread, and be satisfied, albeit just for a day. These French prisoners understood that indefinite starvation is almost unendurable, but one could endure 9 days of deprivation if, at the end, there was one moment of satiation. Lützeck's misfortune was that he did not stay with that group for the requisite 10 days. Like many survivors, Lützeck believed that he was at the end. Had liberation by the Allied armies tarried, had the Germans held out a bit longer, he would not have made it. His words are poignant, powerful. "One afternoon, I was wandering around outside the barracks, waiting for the bread line to form. I passed a barracks window and saw the reflection of a face in the dirty glass. A familiar prisoner who looked like a mausoleum with sunken eyes, hollow cheeks, broken teeth, a skinny neck, and shaved head. I turned to see who was standing beside me, but no one was there. I was looking at myself. I despaired. I had sworn to myself and tried so hard not to become a Muslim, and now I could see that it was too late. I must confess that when I first read Salten's memoir 20 years ago, I was perplexed by the title, the 23rd Psalm. Unlike the psalmist, Lützeck walked through the valley in the presence of death, not its shadow. And he feared evil, rightly so, for God was absent and there was no comfort. Yet he lived to tell the tale, and for this we must forever be grateful." Michael Berenbaum, American Jewish University, Los Angeles, California. Prologue. After more than 50 years, I have returned to Poland. I sit in the back of a taxi riding the 6 miles from Rzeszów to Tietzin and look out the window at the bleak familiar roads. As we approach the town I recognize, the places that marked my childhood. The forests give way to streets bordered by shabby houses stooped with age. I see the homes and shops that once belonged to friends and neighbors. The taxi drops me at the center of town, the market square. It is lined with the same narrow houses and small stores. Today, I will just be a stranger in the square, a foreign tourist taking pictures of run-down houses and overgrown yards. In my rusty Polish, I try to converse with an old man walking down the sidewalk. I greet him and say that I used to live here before the war and that I have come back after so many years. He walks away before I can tell him my name. I approach other elderly people, hoping someone might remember my family. No one wants to bother with a tourist. Nothing is said about the war or the Jews who once lived here. I cross the market square, determined to find a narrow cobblestone alley that led to the old stone synagogue. I stop to ask a shopkeeper how to find the old Tzitzin synagogue, and he shrugs his shoulders as he tells me that the town has never had a synagogue. I walk to the street where I lived with my parents and my brother. I stand at the top of the sloping, crooked hill and feel my heart beating and tears welling up in my eyes. I turn a last corner and see my house. It is an old abandoned wreck. The gardens are trampled and barren, and the giant tree that stood in front of the house has been cut down to a stump. It is my house, with its sienna tile roof and cream stucco walls. I see the original door, handsomely carved from dark wood. Without touching it, I can feel the doorknob in my hand. I remember the house as it used to be. I see my father, tall and handsome in his lawyer's robe, rushing off to the courthouse in the morning. I remember the afternoons that I played in the streets with my friends, and I hear my mother's voice calling me to come for dinner. I remember how my brother, Monik, always left his bicycle leaning up against the front of the house. An older, heavy-set Polish woman steps out onto the second-floor balcony and looks down at me. She does not know that I played up there, outside my parents' bedroom, when I was just a child. I call out to her in Polish that I lived in this house when I was a small boy and ask if I might come inside for a minute to look around. No, she tells me. The house is being remodeled and I cannot let anyone in. She slips quickly inside and shuts the door. In an instant, my chance is over. I had not dared to hope that the house would still be standing, and here I am, crying and fumbling with my camera. I walk back to the market square, turning to look at my house, to capture it in my mind. I get into the taxi and direct the driver to take me back to Rzeszów. He drives down the hill, past the park where I played, and the pond where I skated when the leaves had fallen from the trees and the water had turned to ice. We pass the shops and homes of people I once knew, and who once knew me. Everyone is gone. I remember how I was chased from this town and realize that I will always be a stranger here. I can never escape the memories, never leave them in some house or town, and they shall never let me go. The wall that I have carefully built between the past and present has crumbled and fallen down. And suddenly, everything has changed. And nothing has changed at all. 1. I grew up in a small Polish town named Tychyn. It was close to Rzeszów, a larger city, and our county seat. In Tychyn were the grade school that I attended and the local court where my father practiced law, the high school, county court, railway station, fancy restaurants, and movie theaters were all in Rzeszów, about 6 miles away. 3,000 people lived in Tychyn, and a third of them were Jewish. Most were either quite poor or of modest means. They lived simple and quietly religious lives. Some families owned small shops, or the men worked as tailors, shoemakers, or other tradesmen. A few made a living peddling their wares in nearby villages. Few Jews in our town were professionals. Our lives were comfortable, and we felt we were a welcome part of the community. Tichin was an ideal place to grow up. Its smallness allowed me to know every corner, house, and alley, every bend in the river, each grassy place to play, and the best hills to sled in winter. As I grew to know and love my town. My father, Dr. Henry Saltzman, practiced law in the local court in Tichin and the county court in Jeshov. He was born in the neighboring town of Weinsut, on a farm estate owned by my grandfather, after whom I was named. My father had 3 brothers and 5 sisters. My mother's name was Anna. Her parents, the Hutterers, owned a sawmill in a wooded village 50 miles east of Tichin, on the bank of the River San. My mother had 1 older sister, Pauline, and 2 brothers, Henry and Benik. Pauline married a doctor and moved to Vienna with their 2 children. Henry became a businessman, and Benik studied dentistry in France. We were a large, close-knit family, and gathered on many festive occasions. When my father met my mother, she was a young widow with an infant son, Manik. Her first husband had died before the baby was born. My mother cared for the baby alone until she married my father. She lovingly nicknamed my father Heinrich, and he called her Anzia. I was born on January 7th, 1928, when my brother was 6. I was named Lucian Salzman and nicknamed Lutzek. Ours was a close and loving family. I brought my endless questions and youthful problems to my strong and wise father, and my bruises and bad dreams to my tender and loving mother. As a teenager, Manik was tall, blonde, and handsome. He was a talented artist and musician and very popular. He helped me with my homework and taught me how to ride a bicycle and how to swim in the river. My early years passed, and I flourished in the warm circle of family. I worked hard to be a good student and earned high marks in school. I had many friends, both Catholic and Jewish. I loved books, and especially those about the brave Polish army that defeated the Russians in the Great Battle of Warsaw, and the Polish knights who rescued Vienna during the Turkish siege. My father was a reserve officer in the Polish army and captivated me with his tales of war. But some painful and sobering incidents reminded me that to my Catholic friends, I was a Jew first and not a Pole. On the playground, they called other children fools and ugly. I was called a dirty Jew. Our teacher led our class in morning and afternoon Catholic prayers. The Catholic students stood with their hands clasped, looking toward heaven, while we Jewish students were required to stand with our arms folded and eyes downcast. These were reminders that we were not only different, but also less in the eyes of the Gentiles. One day, my teacher told our class that all people except Jews and Gypsies, the Roma, had ethnic origins. "What about the Jews?" a Catholic student asked. "Where do they come from?" "No one knows," my teacher answered. "They come from nowhere, and they have no roots. They are mongrels." During recess, some boys called me a dirty mongrel Jew. That night, I asked my father why Jews had no roots. He explained that it was not true, and that we were from an ancient biblical people, the Semites. I told him what my teacher had said. He was furious and determined to speak to the principal, who was his old high school classmate. A few days later, my teacher stared at me while he told the class in a sarcastic voice that he was mistaken when he said that Jews were mongrels and that they were actually of Semitic stock. My closest friends and playmates lived in my part of town. Most boys were Catholic, except for Meyer Rab, who was also Jewish. We formed a soccer team and played against other teams in town. In the winter, We had snowball fights and skated on the frozen pond. In the summer, we swam and fished in the river. In the fall, we wandered in the local forests to play and eat wild berries. We roamed the fields and stole apples from the orchard. On rainy days.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?